we are actually quite close to the beginning in that case. Evidently, it's only we've done, I think, 3 paragraphs, right?
Yeah, some, yeah.
Is everybody in the same page? Yeah. I mean, is that what?
Oh. Yeah, I think that's what it is.
4 paragraphs.
Yeah, I think last time we were discussing most of the time.
Hello?
Yeah, yes, Devashish, that's what I'm showing.
Hello.
Devashish, that's... Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And in the other book, it is 928. Page number is 928.
Yeah, I think we read only one paragraph last time.
Right. So essentially, this far is following up from where we started. Last paragraph is talking about the emergence of the true principle of spirituality, and he is talking about the psychic beings, etc. In essence. So first we talk about the psychic entity, where we were, that essentially it is an entirely hidden part in us. An unfoldment of that is the first step toward the spiritual change. So I see that particular paragraph. Yeah, the soul gathers the essence of all our mental vulnerability. Okay, so, yeah, this, are you sure that that's all we did?
That's what
I had a sense we went further. But anyway, here essentially what he's saying is that, you know, in the early stages of evolution, the soul's presence is extremely... hidden. And even with the coming of the human being, initially there is very little evidence of the soul. And what's interesting over here, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that the first evidence of the soul is in the sense that there is something eternal in us. That's something that outlasts the death of the body. So that is how he is defining the first intimation of the soul. He ends that last paragraph with that, by saying that it is easy to regard ourselves as physical beings, or being of life, or mental beings, using life and body, and to ignore the existence of the soul altogether. For the only definite idea that we have of a soul is of something that survives the death of our bodies. But what this is, we do not know, because even if we are conscious sometimes of its presence, we are not normally conscious of its distinct reality, nor do we feel clearly its direct action in our nature. So I find that very interesting, in that that's not what we normally tend to affirm to ourselves, at least in our conditioned nature, socially conditioned nature. Because though modern man is certainly somebody who does not, acknowledge the existence of the soul at all, as he says, ignores the existence of the soul altogether, whatever access that modern man has to anything that he may call the soul is only in terms of idealisms. There are very few people who will publicly affirm the fact that they have an intuition of something that will outlast the death of the body. Now, this is also compounded by our sense of ideologies, religious ideologies, that speak about Well, most religious ideologies do speak about the persistence of some kind of soul, except perhaps a Buddha, in some way or the other, either in some eternal other condition or through reincarnation. But materialism does not accept these things. So modern man, by and large, takes this idea of something which outlasts the death of the body, sort of with a pinch of salt, and often feels it's only wish fulfillment. Now, however, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that that is indeed our first intimation, most primordial, we may say, intimation of the soul existence in us. And last time we were trying to explore that by saying that left to ourselves, without any conditioning, human beings have a sense of alienation towards death. It is as if whatever we call death as a phenomenal reality, as a reality experienced by our senses, is given the lie to by our consciousness. That's why it is so shocking, in a sense. It's as if a phenomenal sensory reality occurs, a material reality occurs, which we can't grasp in terms of consciousness. So there is a certain kind of intuition within the human being that is violated somewhere. And that intuition, the primordial intuition, is the most basic contact with the soul that human beings have. I think that's how he starts off this exploration of the existence of the soul to human beings. So I think from that point we can continue, unless there are any questions or comments.
There was just two things. We can hear you, but there's a lot of background disturbance from your computer. So
are
you, yeah, we can hear you clearly, but just that there's something in the background. If there's some easy way of removing it.
Actually, Sham, I could hear the Vashishta very clearly. I don't hear any disturbance.
Oh, really? So then maybe it's something with my machine. Okay. Vince, you could hear clearly too?
Yes, I could. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, in that case, Devash is there. Maybe it's just me. Yeah, so anyway, so Devash, regarding your comments, what I wanted to say was the structure of the society itself prevents anyone who has such an intuition to express it, correct? Because there's always the notion that, you know, you get branded as weird, etc., for getting this into any mainstream conversation, so to say.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we hide it even from ourselves. We don't tend to recognize it until it is pointed out in a certain way. Actually, this is an interesting fact about the life divine. Throughout, in fact, I think I this is what I found, that there are a variety in places where Sri Aurobindo draws the attention to some intuitive reality which is not a common acknowledgement to ourselves. Now, not that it's not our common experience, but it is not our common acknowledgement to ourselves, because somehow it is socially kind of, you know, marginalized, suppressed, or rejected. So, you know, when you probe it, when you actually, what they call phenomenologies, when you probe the phenomenology of it, you find that, yeah, there is a certain truth to it that inheres in our private experience, but that somehow we don't acknowledge even in our own reflective sort of moments, because it's not given to us to acknowledge it, to language it as such.
Yeah, thank you, Devashish.
So last time we were actually talking about the fact that children have a better sense of this, which is also we realize that this is part of the reason why, you know, if one has a strong connection with one's childhood, there is no real sense of death, of dying, until one encounters it. when one encounters it, it is at first a very alien thing. One doesn't understand what it means at all. But then it settles in as a kind of a sense that one will not see this person ever again. See? But still, it doesn't go deeper than that. At some level, there is a certain disjunction between our experience of consciousness and our experience of absence. So then we, you know, if we admit that to ourselves, then the question is, I think Keka has come on also. Then the question is, you know, what is it in us that to which this is natural? And so that becomes the idea of the soul in us in a very primitive way. That becomes the, I think it's very interesting that Sri Aurobindo introduces the idea of the soul in this way. Rather than in terms of idealisms, because earlier he has spoken about the fact that mankind's so-called spirituality through the history of man, the idea of spirituality has usually taken the form of some sort of idealism. We tend to call the idealistic urge as the spiritual urge. And he is calling for exceeding that, in a sense, arriving at true spirituality. But here he's pointing out that human beings do have a primordial intuition of something that outlasts the death of the body. And that is perhaps a much more, you know, direct connection, to acknowledge that intuition is a more direct connection with the true spirituality. I'd also like to relate this particular intuition he's talking about with the beginning of the Gita. I have mentioned this earlier also, that the very first thing when Arjuna has his famous Vishada, his, you know, dejection, as it is called, is that Sri Krishna points out to him that there is something which is eternal, something in him which is unborn, which outlasts the death of the body, which does not partake in all this action, etc., that is going to either kill or cause to be killed. So that, again, is the same intuition that he is drawing his attention to. That there is something that outlasts. That is the soul. That is the deepest essence of the human. To begin with that intuition is to affirm the possibility of a true spirituality beyond any natural manifestation or expression of it.
Devashish.
Yeah.
Isn't it, if one did experience that within oneself, the persistence of the soul after death and future lives, so forth.
Yeah.
That, in a sense, is a kind of an alienating experience from the rest of the world. I mean, it's a wonderful experience to have, but there are very few people you could actually share that with, and it makes you really, I mean, more aware of the realities other than this reality. But I guess...
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it depends, Vince, on what one calls alienation.
Yes.
Because I think, on the other hand, the insistence on the reality of death is an alienating thing. Because in terms of the inner experience, it doesn't really mean much, or it doesn't hold water. Now, that's the thing about what we call the reversal of consciousness. Now, long before the reversal of consciousness, there is what one calls living within. In other words, the consciousness becomes aware of, or the identity becomes aware of an inner consciousness, that is the inner being. So that inner being itself finds this phenomenology of death to be quite alien. It doesn't understand what it is. in its own experience, whatever has existed will always exist. If it knew somebody who dies, in a sense, that person doesn't die except for some kind of physical, experience related to the expectation of the physical senses.
It can be a very profound inner experience, but I mean, I guess when I say alienation, I mean it's very beautiful, but I guess it's just not it's not a shared belief or whatever. It's just something that happens within oneself.
Yeah, but it can also be shared, Vince, because you see, you're right in that this becomes a social formulation, a social construct, one may say. But nevertheless, this intuition, if it is affirmed, those who affirm it share it because they can also, immediately see. So there is some such intuition within ourselves, you see. So though it is true that society has its own condition factors, apart from one's own experience, ultimately, of course, one's own experience has such a validity, self-evidence, that, it doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks or whether it can be shared or not. But also, it certainly can be experienced by others. And those who do experience, it makes sense to all of those people.
Yeah, I guess it's something to dwell in.
Yeah.
Shall we start reading?
Sure.
Saraja, would you like to start?
Yes, I'll do. Can you hear me, Shyam?
Yeah, nice and clear.
As the evolution proceeds, is that the better I should start, right?
Yeah.
As the evolution proceeds, nature begins slowly and tentatively to manifest our occult parts. She leads us to look more and more within ourselves. Our sets out to initiate more clearly recognizable intimations and formations of them on the surface. The soul in us, the psychic principle, has already begun to take secret form. It puts forward and develops a soul personality, a distinct psychic being to represent it. This psychic being remains still behind the veil in our subliminal path, like the true mentor, the true writer, or the true or subtle physical being within us. But like them, it acts on surface life by the influences and intimation throws up upon the surface. These form part of the surface aggregate, which is the conglomerate effect, the emergence, the visible formation, and the superstructure which we ordinarily experience and think of as ourselves. On this ignorant surface, we become dimly aware of something that can be called a soul as distinct form. It distinct from mind, life or body. We feel it not only as our mental idea, our vague instinct of ourselves, but as a sensible influence in our life and character and action. A certain sensitive feeling for all that is true and good and beautiful, fine and pure and noble. A response to it, a demand for it, a pressure on mind and life to accept and formulate it in our thought, feelings, conduct, character, in the most usual, recognized, the most general and characteristic, though
not the sole sign of resilience of the psyche of the man who has not his, who has not this element in him, or does not respond to all to this urge. We say that he has no soul. But it is this influence that we can most easily recognize as a finer or even a beginner part in us, and the most powerful for the slow journey towards some aim at perfection in our nature.
So now he's talking about that part in us which begins to have some effect on the nature. Now the previous part in us was so primordial that it may have nothing to do with the nature. This is the psychic entity. So that psychic entity in fact has an unbound quality to it. So we can see actually in the Indian terminology, these are the stations of the Atman. In both the stations, one transcendental and one immanent, the Atman is, as a matter of fact, unborn. So as Jivatman, it is transcendental. As Antaratman, it is immanent. The Antaratman is a psychic entity, which in that sense is unformed and unmanifest or unborn in that sense, but still driven in the, you know, latent in its fullness and driven from life to life in the movements of Prakriti. It has accepted that. Now, that, out of that latency, the fullness of the infinite divine starts manifesting or projecting into the nature sheets its influences. So that's where we start finding that there is a very close, intimate relation between Prakriti and Purusha. The dance of Prakriti and Purusha begins in that sense. Because in fact, cosmic nature has come down in this double sense, double form. Ishvara Shakti has come down as Purusha Prakriti, and Purusha is deeply asleep in Prakriti. Only when Prakriti can manifest enough of its own possibilities to cause the awakening of identity in the conscious sense of mind, mental being, does Purusha wake up to that extent that it begins to start forming some kind of relationship with Prakriti in manifestation. That relationship is psychic being. Psychic being is the beginning of the soul personality, which has a certain form because it can sustain an identity. Prior to that, it cannot sustain an identity in its nature part. So psychic entity or psychic principle is both an aspect of Supreme Purusha, Purushottama, and an aspect of Paraprakriti. That's why Gita is saying that in its Supreme Purusha aspect or Purushottama aspect, it is Amsha Sanatana, the eternal portion of Purushottama. In its Prakritic aspect, it is Paraprakriti Jiva Bhuta, the individual becoming of the Supreme Nature. Now, that second aspect cannot start manifesting until Prakriti in the large mass expresses itself to a minimum degree of identity, of self-identity. That happens with the appearance of mind. At that point, we start having a projection of the psychic entity in some kind of nature body. That is the psychic being. A psychic personality develops. A psychic personality, therefore, can have an influence on mind, life, and body. What Sri Aurobindo is talking about here is that this influence passing through this vast gulf of universal nature and its action within our being manifests on the surface as some small influence of some kind of sensitivity, you know, either a mental idealism or some vital quality of courage or generosity or some of the other higher qualities or some physical skill which is remarkable. But whatever way, its manifestation on the surface is unmistakable as something which does not belong purely to nature, that it is something which is an influence of some divine thing, some higher thing in nature. This is the reason why, commonly speaking, people start talking about these kind of influences as being the spiritual life. Normally, because there is a sense that humanity is stuck in a certain identity. This is what we know ourselves as. The idea of an evolutionary humanity does not exist in the common popular mind. Therefore, whatever we call ourselves is an anthropological psychology. That is the definition of the human in terms of a fixed psychological, constituent self. Now, therefore, if that is the case, the sense is that the maximum that we can do is express more and more of these kind of qualities which are taken to be qualities of nature, the so-called spiritual qualities of nature. And that spiritual quality of nature, if there isn't that kind of, social sanction against it, is recognized in some way or the other to be coming from the soul. So people say such and such a person has a soul, and if they don't have these qualities, they say such a person has no soul. This is a very kind of popular way of speaking. And just the only trick to it is the acknowledgement of the fact that some psychic influence escapes on the surface.
Devashish,
yes.
I think I'm experiencing some of the alienation right now. I'm just not sure. I'm still thinking of that Sri Aurobindo's intuitive reality. He hints at, and if one had that experience of the soul persisting after life and before life and for future lives, that's like, it's such a real experience. It's so profound, but yet, I mean, it isn't anything that you could really talk about in most instances. I mean, it's not something you could talk about at the bowling alley or something with the guys, or, but it kind of makes you want to go into the forest and escape a bit.
Well, you're right there, Vince, because the psychic entity, that's why, if you start with that and end with that intuition, you're quite right. I think that is what you meant by the term alienation. You're quite right, because indeed you're being pushed into such a primordial part of your being that there is no connection between that part and nature. That's exactly the reason why this paragraph which we just read gives that connection. And again, it's the same with the Gita. When at first, Krishna has to awaken Arjuna to the sense of this unborn and eternal thing in himself, which outlasts this terrible event that is about to take place. He's saying to him, wait a minute, look into the depth of your being and see what is about to happen is just an illusory bubble, because you persist beyond it. But if it was just that, if that was the end of his message, Arjuna would have been very justified in saying, let me then escape from this horrible phenomenal experience and contemplate just the existence of that unborn self in the cave, in the forest. So what you're saying is, it is almost like a kind of a natural consequence of that contemplation. And there is some justification to that too. We need those hours of pure contemplation of that part of the being, when we can feel that we don't exist here, that we've lived innumerable lives before and have innumerable lives yet to come. A part of us must exist in that dimension. It's a coexistent dimension. with whatever you experience with your nature. But at the same time, the nature must also affirm the other aspect of Chaitya Purusha, of the psychic being, of the psychic entity, as the psychic being, as the individual becoming, the self-becoming of the Prakriti, that we are here to manifest the Divine Mother. So that gives meaning to the life, as it were, and its instruments. So both these have to be related. These two paragraphs that we came across are both very profound aspects of the psychic life. One is the psychic life of qualities, and the other is the psychic life in its purity outside of qualities. Both need to be known, and if that psychic life outside of qualities is not known, then one will not be able to emerge in the fullness of a spiritual life. One will always be constrained to the expression of a spiritual life.
Well, thank you. I think you've summed up some of what I've been feeling, but what I can't quite grasp intellectually or whatever, it's something that I guess I just have to let grow in me. Yeah. Thank you.
Sure, sure. Very true. That's what we all have to do. It's
yes.
A lot to let grow. It's a beautiful way of putting it.
So, Devashish, according to that description of Sri Aurobindo, I'm trying to visualize a person who does not have a soul type of, I'm trying to picturize the history. Can you think of Hitler or somebody to be something like that?
Actually, my sense about it, Sita, is that he's that particular line over there. It's to be kind of taken almost with a pinch of salt. It is like he's saying that human beings make these judgments about soul being soul or not soul purely by the expression on the surface. This is my interpretation at least. You know, because I'll tell you, I mean, maybe this, I don't know whether this is appropriate, but I would like to, you know, on this, since you raised this issue about that, you know, people having a soul saying, you know, see how he puts it over there. He say, of the man who has not this element in him or does not respond at all to this urge, we say that he has no soul. He's not saying that such a person has no soul. He's saying, we say that he has no soul. And there, my sense is that there is a little bit of Aurobindonian irony in that line. Almost like a tongue-in-cheek kind of little smile that he's saying mankind likes to pass judgment on things of the depths by looking at the surface. You know, that particular line, what I was going to say, has a lot of resonance for me because a little after I came across Sri Aurobindo and I sort of was plunged into the inner life, my grandmother died. And honestly, I actually experienced that in a certain way. Nothing of it escaped onto the surface. And I was living in a camp, in a house with some other people who figured out that my grandmother had died. And I remember them saying very clearly to a number of others, this guy has no soul, okay? This very thing that he's talking about over here. Now, evidently, what they were expecting is that I should have been weeping and crying and making a big huff of it, while there was no expression of that kind. Therefore, the surface phenomenon, the surface expression was taken to be a certain evidence of some inner depth, whether there is a soul or not. So this is my sense of what he's saying there, that human beings take this little influence that escapes on the surface to be the definition of the soul. If somebody doesn't have it, doesn't express it, they say that he has no soul.
Thank you.
It's
very nice example.
I mean, I was hesitating to say it, but you know, that particular line has tremendous resonance, practical resonance for me, because I've actually experienced exactly that. That's why I said it.
I remember reading, I think it was in 12 Years or one of the books by the disciples. Somebody asks him, Lord, is there a soul in everyone? And Sri Aurobindo's response was something like, sometimes I too have to take it by faith. So, Devashishtha, when you were giving your comments at the end of this paragraph, you were talking of, some like anthropological psychology or something?
I used that term.
Yeah.
Anthropological psychology.
Yeah. So
but anthropology is the study of man. Yeah, basically, anthropology is the field which tries to define what it means to be human. Okay, what is the definition of the human being? Anthropology tries to proceed by actually studying different cultures and saying that, well, here, this is what it means to be human. The human being can be defined in such and such terms in this culture. Now, if it is a cultural relativism, then naturally we cannot say it becomes racist. You see, we cannot say that there are different kinds of human beings in different cultures. That we may have different ideas of ourselves as human beings, but ultimately we are not different kinds of human beings. So the underlying sort of knowledge or science of anthropology, goal of anthropology, is to arrive at a definition of the human being, a universal definition of the human being. An anthropological psychology would try to arrive at this definition through defining a universal psychology. This is what it means to be human. So what normally happens is that the definition human, that there is an implicit faith here in the idea of an anthropological psychology. There's an implicit faith that mankind can be defined. Okay? That we are a fixed species. Just as we can phenomenally study the tiger or the lion and give a full description of tiger behavior or lion behavior, so too we can do the same with the human being and define the human being by a set of behaviors that relate to certain psychological, you know, descriptions. And that psychological description becomes an anthropological psychology.
Sure, yeah, exactly.
But the point I was making is that if we do that, then we are, you know, we are constrained to accepting ourselves as we are right now, as the final product. Well, for Sri Aurobindo, we are a transitional being. And therefore, an anthropological psychology, if it is to be built, can't be built on empirical studies of who we are right now. It can only be built by a knowledge of our full potential. And we don't have that. That does not, what escapes on the surface is so little of the psychic being. How can we know what we are?
Yeah, exactly, Devashishtha. That was going to pretty much be my question or comment, that such a psychology would, you know, kind of freeze the definition of the human both across like all cultures as well as over time, correct? Whereas once we accept evolution, that may not, such a freezing may not be appropriate anymore, right?
Devashishtha, anything other than human is not transitional.
No, we're not saying that. I mean, what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that humankind is a transitional being. Now, actually he is saying that other entities are not transitional in the same way. That's partly because Purusha is still asleep. You see the point that you are making. Psychic entity is in all things. But psychic being only emerges with the human. The emergence of psychic being is a very, very profound thing, because it's as if the psychic element, the divine element in us, the Purusha in us, has begun having a certain kind of relationship with the Prakriti. Before that, it doesn't have a dynamic relationship with the Prakriti. It has only a static and latent relationship with the Prakriti. Now it begins to have a dynamic relationship with the Prakriti. As a result, it can modify and transform Prakriti. That reversal of consciousness becomes possible. That is the sign or the mark of the transitory nature of the human being. Prior to that, that transitioning possibility is not there.
Actually, the question I was having was, my analogy, the way I was thinking about it was like, there was a discussion before about Vishwamano and archetypal type of human being that is there, and which is also going through some, which is doing its own tapas, and we're part of it. And similar to that, we have archetype of every other being also. So, in a way, whatever is the transitional nature is applicable to both. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking in terms of that.
Tell me again, applicable to what? Applicable to which world?
No, to other beings also are also part of this transition. They are also moving in their own way. They are also evolving in their own way.
Yeah, no, you see the difference is, Sita, I mean, you're right, that we can talk about the tapas of some kind of entity, like a Vishwamana. We can talk like that about tapas of various entities that are ultimately affecting the Prakriti of that particular species. Now, however, Vishwamana is also basically a static idea. It is the idea of a certain kind of, essence that is exploring itself. So, for example, a dog or a cat or whatever, you may say that there is a certain evolution from life to life that may take place in a dog. Ultimately, maybe it might transition into a human being. But dog nature is pretty much empirically definable, you see, because dog Purusha doesn't have the power to transform dog Prakriti. See, now in the human case, when we are talking about Vishwamana, the same Vishwamana is acting in the human being in that same manner. But the Purusha element in the human being can know its identity with that Vishwamana and change its tapas. You see, that's where the conditional element comes. It's within your agency, not within the agencies of some superior being who has given you a certain shape here on earth. But you as a human being, as an individual, can ultimately know your identity with that whose tapas has projected the human and can actually effect a change in the nature. In that sense, mankind is transitional. Our ceiling is open-ended because psychic being has emerged.
Thank you. One thing I was thinking, how about this four aspects of mother, like Maheshwari, Mahakali, I mean, like one, the direct identity, another is this Pragyana. I mean, basically, Vijnana, Pragyana, Samgyana, and Ajnana, these four aspects coexisting, and it is actually manifesting. I mean, whichever inferior way or whichever invisible way, but it is nevertheless not absent in all the things that we do or all the things that we feel. That thing, can we say that it is only human
being?
No, you see, because those four, as you pointed out, they are active in Prakriti. They are qualities of Prakriti. Now, therefore, they are active in all things, not only in the human being. They are active in some way or form in all things, in cosmic nature itself. But in the human being, they become individualized. And it becomes possible for the human being to attain to conscious identity. That is the Prakritic part. That the psychic being can know itself to be one with each one of these, in its, again, in its ability to transform the human nature. So it can be individualized. That's the difference.
I'm not sure what, I mean, why, okay, individualized, what I meant is that this is, its dynamic manifestation is found only in human nature. That's how, I mean, that is one of the differences of human being from other species. So that's what I was thinking. Are you saying yes or no?
Can you explain dynamic manifestation again? How do you...
dynamically, yeah.
In terms of animals.
No, I'm saying dynamically defining this four coexisting qualities. Like, for example, I mean, when we interact with someone, we do have a contact. I mean, however inferior or however sleeping that is, some kind of direct contact, and another is that, I mean, you know, and so on. Prajna and Samgyana is that kind of unity, like a separative and at the same time some kind of, you know, Shravindo defines it very well in Knowledge by Identity chapter, I guess. Anyway, but basically these four jnanas, okay, these four in every interaction and... hello? Yeah. In every interaction, we experience it. That thing, can it be said that it is only, amongst the existing species, it's only human beings who experience it?
As far as I understand it is active at all levels of the Prakriti, at all levels of nature, even with other creatures, all four of them are active. But
gotcha.
at the human level, it is more consciously experienced. In other words, we can be conscious of each of these. Again, because of the psychic being, there's the chance of being really consciously present, ultimately of identifying each of them and being one with them. That certainly is unique only to me.
Okay.
Vince, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. But this psychic influence or action does not come up to the surface quite pure or does not remain distinct in its purity. If it did, we would be able to distinguish clearly the soul element in us and follow consciously and fully its dictates. In occults, mental and vital and subtle physical action intervenes, mixes with it, tries to use it, and turns it to its own profit, dwarfs its divinity, distorts or diminishes its self-expression, even causes it to deviate and stumble, or stains it with the impurity, smallness, and error of mind and life and body. After it reaches the surface, thus alloyed and diminished, it is taken hold of by the surface nature in an obscure reception in ignorant formation. And there is, or can be, by this cause, a still further deviation and mixture. A twist is given. a wrong direction is imparted, a wrong application, a wrong formation, an erroneous result of what is in itself pure stuff and action of our spiritual being. A formation of consciousness is accordingly made, which is a mixture of the psychic influence in its intimations jumbled with mental ideas and opinions, vital desires and urges, habitual physical tendencies. They coalesce too with the obscured soul influence. The ignorant, though well-intentioned efforts of these external parts towards a higher direction, a mental ideation of a very mixed character, often obscure even in its idealism, sometimes even disastrously mistaken, a fervor and passion of the emotional being, throwing up its spray and foam of feelings, sentiments, sentimentalisms, a dynamic enthusiasm of the life parts, eager responses of the physical, the thrills and excitements of nerve and body. All these influences coalesce in a composite formation, which is frequently taken as the soul in its mixed and confused action for the soul stirrer. For a psychic development in action or realized inner influence, the psychic entity is itself free from stain or mixture, but what comes up from it is not protected by that immunity. Therefore, this confusion becomes possible.
So, this small paragraph, or relatively small paragraph, really gives us a window into how difficult it is to arrive at the purity of the psychic being. How easy it is to confuse something else as the psychic. So he's pointing to first three different elements that are confusions, or that are confusing the action of the psychic on the surface nature. Firstly, there is all this intervening inner material, inner physical, mental, vital consciousnesses. So these are intervening between the depth of the psychic and the surface nature. Anything coming from the psychic has to pass through these things. And these things usually immediately appropriate whatever is coming through the psychic or from the psychic. As Sri Aurobindo has pointed out earlier, how when some true psychic impulse passes through the mind immediately turns it into mental stuff. Its psychic character is completely diminished and completely modified into mental character. It's translated into mental consciousness. And in that translation, a huge part of its reality just completely disappears. The same happens at the emotional level. The same happens at the level of will. The emotional level, it's very clear in what is usually called devotion. The tremendous amount of distortion takes place in what is normally called devotion of the same psychic impulse coming to the emotional being. Now, whatever happens of that arrives at the surface consciousness. So the second level of the problem is there is a surface formation of identity, the surface ego, what we take ourselves to be. Now that is receiving this amalgam of a variety of influences from within and from without. All the environmental forces are coming to it. It's already conditioned responses, its blind spots and agreements and disagreements. And into that, these transform the modified, translated effects of the psychic along with mental, vital and physical, you know, impulses are coming. So there it does its own level of judgment and its own level of mistranslation and distortion at the surface consciousness. So that has its own intelligence, as it were. And then the third is the most pathetic of the three, as he's pointing out. Each one of these, the mental, vital and physical, have their well-intentioned but ignorant kinds of aspirations. See, the coalesced with the obscured soul influence, the ignorant, the well-intentioned efforts of these external parts towards a higher direction. A mental ideation of a very mixed character, because the problem with the human being is, until we arrive at a certain depth or height of consciousness, we have no idea how small we are or how ignorant we are. The depth of our ignorance completely escapes us. And we feel that we have tremendous amount of wisdom to deal with the world. If only God listened to us, he would have had a perfect world by now. There is some kind of an intuition like that in most people's ignorant natures. So that is the part which puts in its own opinion, as it were, to whatever is coming from the psychic and already distorted in the surface nature. So both from the viewpoint of all these, the mental ideation of a mixed character, which has its own, you know, obscured ignorance, but takes it to be aggressively, takes it to be the truth. As he says, often obscure even in its idealism, sometimes even disastrously mistaken. Then you have the emotional being, a fervor and passion of the emotional being. And this can be even more dangerous because, again, it feels it's very well intentioned. It's protecting the divine. See? It's taking up cudgels to protect the gods. So, throwing up its prey and form of feelings, sentiments, sentimentalisms. Similarly, a dynamic enthusiasm of the life parts, eager responses of the physical, thrills and excitements of nerve and body. This has been, in fact, the story of mysticism in a very perverse manner, a highly mixed up manner in many cultures. We find, for example, in the whole idea of Persian mysticism, there is a whole layer of this kind of, you know, sort of distortion brought in by some kind of sensuous expression that completely misses the point and mixes it up with exactly what he's talking about, the thrills and excitements of nerve and body. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that that's all there is to it and that there isn't a much more profound aspect to the same culture. But I'm saying such things also develop along with whatever else due to the natural problems of the human nature. And our eagerness to label something as being of the soul. Very quickly we accept these things as being of the soul, and therefore it gives us a certain kind of legitimacy to feel as if it is a divine thing that we've arrived at. All these influences, more or less, in a composite formation which is frequently taken as the soul, and its mixed and confused action of the soul stir, psychic development, an action or a realized inner influence. Now, the psychic entity is itself free from stain or mixture, but what comes up from it is not protected by that immunity. Therefore, this confusion becomes possible. So immediately in this paragraph, he gives us a very graphic picture of the varieties of distortion that naturally intervene in the action of the soul in modern humanity. So it also gives us a tremendous, you know, sort of insight into the amount of purification that is necessary and the necessity of arriving at soul and its expression in its purity.
I mean, is it also possible that, you know, that kind of psychic glimpse or spark, you can even see it has come and then it is faded with all kinds of gravity of the physical itself. Like it may not even if mind does see it, can do nothing about it. It's like it helplessly observes that it is the moment it came, all kinds of gravitation is sort of pulling it down, and it's going away. So that sort of thing. Can it be also attributed to physical inertia or gravitation?
No, certainly that can, because like he's saying, there are three different levels of distortion taking place, and it's very possible that one or other of them does not occur, actually. But there is a certain emergency. See, he will see one of the things that we were studying earlier is that Sri Aurobindo points out that this paragraph is a good example of why that is necessary. He points out in a place in the synthesis of yoga that there has to intervene another level of progress before the psychic transformation. So when he's talking about the triple transformation, there he's talking about four transformations. The first one is what he calls the emergence of the yogic consciousness. Emergence of the yogic consciousness is sort of what you are talking about, which is that the mind is free enough, or mental purusha is free enough, to be able to distinguish. It has the distinguishing capacity. So it can observe and see that, yeah, these things are false or these things are true, or there is a sufficient strength with which the psyche comes through. And there is an observation of the fact there is something true to it. But nevertheless, the other parts of the nature, maybe the gravitation, as you're saying, of the physical, or the habits of the vital, are not allowing it to, one is helpless because they are not allowing it to actually be accepted, even in one's own nature. That can very well be the case.
Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Keka would like to read.
Is it the mode over the psychic being, or which one?
Yeah, that mode over the psychic.
Moreover, the psychic being, the soul personality in us, does not emerge full-grown and luminous. It evolves, passes through a slow development and formation. Its figure of being may be at first indistinct, and may afterwards remain for a long time weak and undeveloped, not impure, but imperfect. For it rests its information, its dynamic self-building on the power of soul that has been actually and more or less successfully against the resistance of ignorance and inconscience put forth in the evolution upon the surface. Its appearance is the sign of a soul emergence in nature. And if that emergence is as yet small and defective, the psychic personality also will be stunted or feeble. It is too, by the obscurity of our consciousness, separated from its inner reality, in imperfect communication with its own source in the depths of the being. For the road is as yet ill-built, easily obstructed. The wires often cut or crowded with communications of another kind and proceeding from another origin. Its power to impress what it receives upon the outer instruments is also imperfect. In its penury, it has fought most things to rely on these instruments, and it forms its push to expression and action on their data, and not solely on the honoring perceptions of the psychic entity. In these conditions, it cannot prevent the true psychic light from being diminished or distorted in the mind into a mere idea or opinion, the psychic feeling in the heart into a fallible emotion or mere sentiment, the psychic will to action in the life burst into a blind vital enthusiasm or a fervid excitement. It even accepts these mistranslations for want of something better and tries to fulfill itself through them. For it is part of the work of the soul to influence mind and heart and vital being and turn their ideas, feelings, enthusiasm, dynamisms in the direction of what is divine and luminous. But this has to be done at first, imperfectly, slowly, and with a mixture. As the psychic personality grows stronger, it begins to increase its communion with the psychic entity behind it and improve its communications with the surface. It can transmit its intimations to the mind and heart and life with a greater purity and force, for it is more able to exercise a strong control and react against false mixtures. Now more and more it makes itself distinctly felt as a power in the nature. But even so, this evolution would be slow and long if left solely to the difficult automatic action of the evolutionary energy. It is only when man awakes to the knowledge of the soul and feels a need to bring it to the front and make it the master of his life and action that a quicker conscious method of evolution intervenes and a psychic transformation becomes possible.
So here he is pointing out the other aspect of the problem, which is it is not merely that there are all these layers of ignorance. There are these other kinds of laws, dharmas, which are being imposed on the psyche, or that there is a certain appropriation of the psyche by the surface ego, or its destruction by other kinds of laws and idealisms. But the psychic being itself is not strong enough in being. And so he's pointing to this fact that the psychic being itself is an evolutionary being. It is evolving. Psychic entity may be static, but psychic being is evolutionary. This is why, again, coming back to what you were saying, the essence of man as a transitional being is very closely related to the fact that psychic being belongs to the human being. Psychic being is evolutionary. That sentence there is very interesting, how he points out what is the basis of the psychic being in its emergence in nature. He says, its figure of being may be at first indistinct and may afterwards remain for a long time weak and undeveloped, not impure, but imperfect. For it rests its formation, its dynamic self-building, on the power of soul that has been actually and more or less successfully against the resistance of ignorance and inconscience put forth in the evolution upon the surface. So in other words, in that sentence itself you can see that formation of the psychic being is like a two-way process. To what extent is nature receptive to it? How much of it does it allow? to come to the surface. And it's almost like, you know, the strength of the psychic being develops to an even greater extent. To the extent that the nature under gives itself to it. It's almost like it feeds on the ability of nature to operate some place. So psychic being is this formation of the soul, of the psychic entity, which is in relation with nature, Prakriti. And this relation is mediated by the three stations of the Purushas, the mental Purusha, vital Purusha, and physical Purusha, mediate between psychic Purusha and Prakriti. So to the extent that these Purushas are powerful over their own Prakritis, and psychic being is in control of these Purushas, to that extent, psychic being or psychic entity, psychic Purusha is in control of these Purushas. To that extent, psychic being becomes more powerful. In becoming more powerful, it influences or controls mental nature, vital nature, and physical nature more powerfully. That entire process is an evolutionary process. It doesn't start off like that. It goes through that process. Now, the way he ends is by pointing out that this process is being achieved in a certain way by nature itself. Nature is going through a certain kind of process in each individual through our lives that is increasing this possibility, increasing this dynamic. But still, if we were to rely on nature to bring about these changes, it would take an enormous amount of time. The saving factor is that in its development, at a certain point, the jiva, the individual being, the individualized being, even if you call it whatever, mental ego or whatever, suddenly realizes that this is happening and gives attention to it. This giving of attention is an invitation to the psychic being to start speeding up its formation and control over nature. This becomes the opening of a door to the reversal of consciousness. That's why he ends by saying that now more and more it makes itself distinctly felt as a power in the nature when that starts happening. But even so, this evolution would be slow and long if left solely to the difficult automatic action of the evolutionary energy. It is only when man awakes to the knowledge of the soul and feels the need to bring it to the front and make it the master of his life and action that a quicker conscious method of evolution intervenes and a psychic transformation becomes possible. So that is the initiation into yoga, essentially. All that he's been talking about so far is natural action, action of soul in nature. With the human being, that action becomes a little more conscious in that, in an occult way, the formation of the psychic being begins. It is very weak, but nevertheless, it starts having some kind of influence on the nature. Once it develops to a certain degree, as it were, knocks on the door of the ego. And some part of the jiva realizes that this is the thing that is happening, it turns its attention to it. At that point, the yoga begins and the reversal of consciousness starts its journey, leading to this rapid kind of, you know, process of the emergence of the psyche.
Hmm. Debashista, you use the word psychic purusha. Is that, do you mean psychic being with that, or do you want to distinguish it with some other thing like psychic prakriti?
Yeah, it's a little difficult because when Sri Aurobindo uses the word soul personality, he's using it also indistinguishably with the term psychic being. Now, usually Sri Aurobindo uses the term being to mean purusha. And also in terms of psychic being, he's translated it as chaitya purusha. But psychic being also has qualitative existence. In other words, psychic being is also a prakriti, a psychic prakriti. So either we have to distinguish the purusha part of psychic being as the psychic entity itself. See, that is, the psychic entity is the psychic purusha. Or we have to say that psychic being has got a psychic purusha and psychic prakriti. I was using it more in the sense of psychic entity itself being called psychic purusha.
So what is the psychic prakriti? It is not the same thing as the three gunas of the lower nature.
No, definitely not. It is basically the modulation of psychic consciousness as a pure prakriti. And basically that is, it is para prakriti jiva bhuta. It is an aspect of para prakriti. Just as psychic being is an aspect of Ishvara, psychic prakriti is an aspect of para prakriti.
Oh, so we can say it is the shakti in us, which also the tantrics would say as the kundalini shakti.
No. Kundalini shakti is the evolutionary energy which has become individualized in us. Now, that is actually prakriti. Prakriti in its essence is that evolutionary force. But psychic being, as psychic personality or psychic shakti, is basically, you know, you may say a portion of the divine mother. That's why four aspects of the mother are, when what Keta was talking about, the four knowledges, you know, the four shaktis of the four knowledges of supermind are ultimately the sources of the psychic prakriti. Psychic prakriti is the child. That in that sense, it's a portion of the divine mother.
So do the Upanishads speak about this? The fact that we are also a spark of the divine mother and not the just the spark of the Purusha?
Upanishads are not very clear about it as far as I know. This particular aspect of Purusha and Prakriti or Ishvara and Shakti, it's brought out most clearly in the Gita, in those two terms that describe the soul. Now, returning to your question about the Kundalini Shakti, this is how I understand that. See, the Holocaust of Prakriti has two actions. That is, you know, the what is known as the sacrifice of Purusha and the sacrifice of Prakriti. The sacrifice of Purusha is preceded by the sacrifice of Prakriti. That preceding action, the sacrifice of Prakriti, is the appearance of the inconscient. Appearance of the inconscient is basically the becoming latent of the divine Shakti in the form of inconscience. That is the cosmic Kundalini, if you want to call it that. So that is a cosmic evolutionary force which is going to work in the entire evolution. But with the emergence of individuality, so that is all, let me back up and say that is the first descent of Prakriti, the first sacrifice of Prakriti. The second sacrifice of Prakriti proceeds with the sacrifice of Purusha. The sacrifice of Purusha is the fragmentation of divine being as person into all the various, you know, constituents of nature. Now, along with that individuation, there also descends the Paraprakriti. So, Purushottama and Paraprakriti individualized in the individual being, in the human being, is the psychic being. But the primordial descent of Parapakriti as the cosmic holocaust of the mother, which is the power of evolution in the unconscious, that also is individualized in each human being as the Kundalini Shakti. So we have, one may say, two stations of Purusha and two stations of Prakriti inside us, or two stations of Ishvara and two stations of Shakti inside us. The two stations of Ishvara are, one is above as the Purushottama, or even if one comes down into the terrestrial nature, it is the Ishvara above, in the over mind, if you want to call it that. And then the other station of the Purusha is in the psychic being. The two stations of the Prakriti, again, one is in the psychic being, and the other is the evolutionary force individualized as part of our inconscient reality.
So the name of that Purusha who is above is Jivatman, and the one that is in us is the Chaitya Purusha.
Now, Jivatman is only an aspect of that Purusha, because you see, Jivatman is Akshara Purusha, while psychic being is Shara Purusha. So if we look at those as the two aspects of Purushottama, then we can say that these are the two stations in the ignorance of that which is integral in the knowledge, in the vidya. Again, the same way we can say the two stations in the ignorance of the Prakriti are one as the psychic nature and one as the Kundalini Shakti.
In which writing does Sri Aurobindo discuss the two Shaktis in us?
Actually, I haven't come across it very clearly anyway. I've come across hints of it, but just like this whole thing about the psychic being also, he hasn't been very explicit about it. He has left it in hints. There's a lot that Sri Aurobindo has left in hints. But, you know, perhaps because nobody queried him sufficiently.
What is it about again? One, please. Two what?
The two Prakritis, two stations of Prakriti, as the Kundalini and the psychic Prakriti. There is no place where he has explicitly talked about it, but there are a variety of places where he has touched on it.
I suppose he talked more about the two kinds of Purushas, right? Two kinds of psychic. Yeah, Keka, you're causing a lot of disturbance. Can you mute? Yeah, Devashita was saying that perhaps Sri Aurobindo has talked more about the psychic being and the transcendental being in the individual.
Yeah, that's true, because you see, you know, the reliance in this yoga is on the higher power. So he has talked about both, you know, psychic being, Ishvara, and also Paraprakriti acting from above as Shakti descending into the being, rather than about the Kundalini Shakti which is below. But if you look at Savitri, you find that evolutionary force is certainly invoke, and that is the power that ultimately allows the full expression of the being. It has to be unlocked below. Then you find the full expression of the divine consciousness can take place.
Mm-hmm.
Without that unlocking, that completion is not there.
Is it possible that it can be gradually unlocked by Mother's grace and we won't even know about it distinctly until it reaches some kind of developed phase where we start seeing its influence?
Yeah, in fact, that is what you're saying is quite right. In fact, you know, that is almost like the kind of, you know, usual way in this yoga, in that, you know, the descending Shakti gradually unlocks the Shakti from below. It starts rising, ascending. And sometimes it is an imperceptible process that the two currents meet, as it were. And, you know, there is the fullness of the expression without one's even being aware of this sudden process that the tantrics talk about. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, sudden process may also occur, and may occur at any stage. And in Savitri, it is described in that form as a sudden process. But there is also, you know, Sri Aurobindo has also talked about exactly what you said, that there is a gradual preparation of the nature, and a gradual ascent of the Shakti also, with the action of the force from above.
So I would think Sri Aurobindo's yoga is more top-down, like invoke the mother's help, and that is going to open up, so to say, the chakras rather than concentrate on the chakras from the bottom up.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
In fact, I don't know, instinctively, it feels very scary to, I have heard a few of these kind of chakras. I mean, initially it sort of comes down or has some kind of hypnotic effect, but somewhere it scares me. I don't know whether it is my inability or can you comment on that?
No, the reason also why Sri Aurobindo kind of discourages that process is because, exactly as you're saying, it actually passes through the layers of ignorance. And you see, that's the reason why psychic being, he's talking a lot about psychic being. Why? Because psychic being is much purer. It is the divine consciousness itself. While Kundalini Shakti is asleep in ignorance, it's the consciousness that is asleep in the density of ignorance. If we are trying to raise it, it is going to pass through the ignorance to come out. The purification of the subliminal nature is easier than to try and purify the inconscient. Inconscient is the last bastion of ignorance. So, you know, those who open up that by physical processes, that's how it's done. And it may have been the first, earliest layer of Indian yoga, perhaps, with, you know, these kind of asanas and pranayama processes that, you know, kind of go down to the kundalini. Even there, it's not the entire kundalini that they managed to open up. Because if they were truly going to open up the entire kundalini, there would have been full transformation of the being into a divine body. Okay? That does not happen. So, as a result, it's only partially kundalini that is opened up. And that's the reason why they say that unless a guru who has had these experiences and has complete control over these particular experiences is there with you, this can be very dangerous, because it rises to all the levels of ignorance. And it creates all kinds of disturbances of the nature. It can really, you know, create a very chaotic kind of form of experience. Now, it's interesting, there was somebody who had this experience spontaneously. Okay? I don't know if any of you have heard of this person. His name is Gopi Krishna. He was a Kashmiri person. And this person, maybe he had tried a little bit of yoga or God knows what, but he suddenly had this experience of the Kundalini rising, and he got completely, he became crazy basically, and he had also physical, you know, manifestations, which were extremely disturbing and abnormal to the most. And in that condition, he didn't know what had happened to him because there was no guru around. So he went around asking a number of people what had happened, and they couldn't even explain or kind of give him answers. Finally, he wrote to Sri Aurobindo. He was alive at that time. This man was writing from Kashmir. Now, it's interesting because this letter, the answer by Sri Aurobindo, turns up in the collected works or collected letters of Sri Aurobindo. I think it's in Sri Aurobindo's path and other paths, something of those chapters. But we know that it is Gopi Krishna's letter because Gopi Krishna wrote a book on his own autobiography in which he quotes this entire letter also. Now there basically Sri Aurobindo explains to him that he has had a spontaneous experience of the Kundalini rising, and it has created tremendous disturbances in his being because the being was not ready. Purification was not there, and stability was not there. So then this man writes to Sri Aurobindo saying, I have no other guru, can you accept me as your disciple? And Sri Aurobindo refuses him, saying that your path is different. Your path is that of the tantric, you know, sort of development. But I will help you, he says in there. And this man says that within a month or so, all these disturbances got stabilized and peace entered into him. And he attributes that to Sri Aurobindo's occult help. But this is the problem, that it creates tremendous disturbances if one has not been prepared for a long time. But also it rises through all these layers of the subjective consciousness, which are extremely ignorant and full of all kinds of distortions.
I mean, is it also possible that with a few things, one is probably just the evolution and the time, that ancient people were more equipped with this kind of opening, whereas more and more, I mean, these days, probably it is less applicable. And another thing I was thinking is that whether Sri Aurobindo and the mother have put forth some kind of occult force in the nature, I mean, in the atmosphere, which is still prevailing, and that is also why we see more people being more receptive towards this, you know, top to bottom, I mean, you know, top down kind of thing, influence, rather than Kundalini rising up and that kind of influence.
Yeah, you see, actually, yeah, that's very true and very good question, because it's true that this is how I understand it, that you're exactly as you said, the evolution of the human consciousness has moved to a certain point where mental maturity has increased a lot. So as far as the Shakti is concerned, the receptivity of the mental consciousness to the planes above is potentially much greater than it was in earlier times. So in those earlier times, physicalist methods were used. It's very interesting because you also notice, as an art historian, I've studied how the human form, depictions or expressions of the human form in yoga, in Indian culture, change over time. The earliest ones are shown not in the lotus posture, but in a variety of yogic postures that are related to the raising of the Kundalini. But as time proceeds, this gives way to an ideal form in which the being sits in Padmasana. And meditation becomes the kind of preferred you know, description of yoga. Now, this arises further to this point where Shakti is descending from above. So at this time, what is possible may not have been possible before. It may be that this descending Shakti from above was so far away that it was not possible to access it. Now, when Sri Aurobindo is writing, and this is what the other question you asked, actually it's very interesting because I don't have any exact answer on that, but this is what my senses of being is, that our intuition is, and that is that even before the mother came, Sri Aurobindo had stuck upon this method and felt that now it was possible for human beings to receive this Shakti from above. So when Kapali Shastri came to him, for example, this was before the mother actually came. You see, Kapali Shastri came to Sri Aurobindo before the mother came and asked to become his, actually had a conversation with him and then asked him if he could, how he could do this yoga. And Sri Aurobindo points above and draws a line descending and says, you can get it from above. And then he points to himself and says, oh, you can get it from me. And he leaves the choice to him. This is a very interesting point, because essentially what he's saying is that it is available to people to draw it from above, to open to the Shakti descending from above. See? Of course, Kapali Shastri accepts Sri Aurobindo as his guru and says, I want it from you. And that begins their relationship. But the other aspect of it is that if he takes Sri Aurobindo even at face value, then the mother is actually the embodiment of that Paraprakriti. And that means that she is the bridge who has brought that consciousness into the terrestrial. So that particular physicalization, that embodiment, reaches its final acme, it reaches its fulfillment in 1956 with the descent and manifestation of supramental consciousness. So we may say that this possibility already opens up from the time Sri Aurobindo is talking about it. It becomes more concrete when the mother arrives. And it becomes most concrete today with the descent of the supramental consciousness. So it is in a way the thing that is available to all of humanity today to open to this descending consciousness, because it is here now, for which it was never before. Mankind was not ready for it before. So we had to draw on the energy from below. Mankind became much more ready for it by the time Sri Aurobindo came. So he was calling on human beings to open above. And nature itself is receiving an uninterrupted flow now with the work that they have done.
Oh, Devashish.
Yeah, Vince.
I think what Keiko was saying is true, though. I mean, you can actually meditate on chakras and have experiences that there's not, that you're not ready for. I mean, I'm speaking from individual experience, things can be.
Yeah.
You can open yourself up to very powerful experiences. I mean.
No, I agree. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, it's,
which you may not be ready for. You're quite right.
Absolutely, yeah.
But the bushes are the point that people are doing more top-down yoga and not doing the Kundalini yoga. I don't know how right it is, because there is a lot of following of that Kundalini yoga also in this, all these Kriya systems, which has a huge following.
That is true that there is a lot of following of that Kundalini yoga type thing going on today. There has been a resurgence of that whole Kundalini system in today's world, and I really don't know how, safe all that is. At least in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, it is not preferred.
Yeah, I think that in that lady disciple, how'd it work? Bhuktananda had an interpreter or something that became a big guru now.
Yeah.
And their whole realization, their whole work is based on opening up the Shakti. Somehow they must have figured something out.
A lot of the traditional schools are going in that direction. But you see, the thing is that, you know, this is the interesting part, that perhaps what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that it's a totally new opening. I mean, it's not necessary to go the traditional way. But it's not that getting into contact with all these various traditional yogas is the way to the future, you know. People may do it and speed up certain aspects. There's no doubt certain aspects of consciousness may be sped up by asanas, by pranayama, by meditation, particularly meditation, but all these things. But it has become available for human beings in everyday life to open to a descending energy from above. In active life, in all life is yoga.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, I mean, I was under the impression that, correct me if I'm wrong, that this kind of like worldwide moralities or some kind of nobility against extinction or destruction, this sort of thing, I felt that it was coming from that kind of top-down influence, which is, they may not be declaring that they're doing yoga, but it is nevertheless that influence. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't think it's top down. I mean, in the older systems, isn't it, you go up, bottom
yeah,
up?
I think what Kekha is talking about, Vince, is not that, not those movements. She's talking about the new evolutionary spirituality, which is, there's a kind of a new movement of worldwide evolutionary spirituality. There is a sense that we are evolving to something. I'm apart from Sri Aurobindo's movement, you know, like with these people like Telad the Shardan, to some extent with a lot of the new age movements, there is a sense that we are evolving into a higher species. And
yes,
many of these beings, these people, have some conception of a descending energy. I think this is what she's talking about. So it's a very interesting phase in which you have all these various yogas, you may say, that have opened up. Each one is an approach towards some kind of aspect of the inner world. But, of course, among all those aspects, Sri Aurobindo is giving a certain path. It isn't that he's leaving it completely open. He's certainly giving a path and saying that there are certain things which are, you know, safer, easier, more central than other things. Of course, it's possible that following any path, one may stumble upon Sri Aurobindo's yoga or achieve its goals. But certainly he's pointing out that the safest one is to make the guide into the psychic being, to draw from the higher, sources of Shakti, and to release the Ishvara above to become the master of the nature. So, you know, this triple transformation process automatically leads to that other station of the Prakriti being transformed, opening up the Prakriti, without actually going through the more dangerous process of opening these things up in an unprepared nature. The other thing with the people who open these things up is that they're not really into an integral yoga. So, you know, whatever impurities remain in the being, they take it as natural. They are also into some kind of anthropological psychology. It's a different, alternate one. But nevertheless, they take it that this is what humanity is all about.
So it's perhaps that these yogas, traditional yogas starting from the Kundalini, are more result-oriented. So it's easier to gauge one's progress. Whereas in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, since we are working on the outward nature, which is like a dog's tail, so it's much harder to gauge it and it's difficult to sustain one's interest.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. Result-oriented meaning it's a certain kind of result, you know, which may be also, a kind of partial thing. And again, in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, it is not necessary that there might be times when one's interest flags, but certainly to the extent that the psychic being emerges there is a kind of an abundance of interest, unflagging interest in the yoga that can become one's constant companion.
No, measuring one's progress, I meant having experiences.
Yeah, maybe. But you see, also there, one has to question, what does one mean by experiences? Because here, I mean, in Sri Aurobindo's yoga also, you know, one might not be experiencing supermind or overmind. But experiences are constantly going on. It's a very rich field of inner life. Because by dint of the fact that, that it's an integral yoga, there are many aspects of the being that are being worked on at the same time. Many of which aspects have no place in the other yogas. They are not even treated as having any kind of reality. And most of those other things are basically, sort of rejected. So, the idea is that a certain kind of, process will lead to certain experiences. And having those experiences, maybe one has those experiences quicker, I don't know. And that might give the sense that one is achieving something. But if one does not fix these kind of goals, then I think there is an abundance of experiences in Sri Aurobindo's path, a variety of natures.
Yes.
Another aspect of it is that I feel that, like we were talking about this ascent of the Kundalini force occurring almost imperceptibly, a lot of changes take place and a lot of things happen which are not so overt. It's not so a sudden experience that, as it were, something changes in the consciousness. But it is often through imperceptible changes of consciousness that you experience only the effects. And sometimes you don't even acknowledge the effects. You don't realize that this has happened, so to speak. That often happens in this world.
Yeah, this is not an exact science.
Yeah, in that sense, yeah. So if you look at the record of yoga, Sri Aurobindo is treating it almost like an exact science. He is stating very clear goals, but these are subjective goals, not goals of the, which include experiences of very, sort of distinct nature. And at the same time, they have to do with a lot of subjective changes of state.
Yeah, maybe we can say he uses the scientific method, but not the scientific instruments of material science.
Yeah.
So shall we end here with a short meditation?